So we've got two new releases that you sent me, and I'm really digging Southern Comfort.
Thank you.
You issued a 2000 CD, Motor City Moments, that paid tribute to the Southern influences musically in your hometown of Detroit. And you had a release out a few years ago looking at African roots music. Your latest release is on Sony. It's Southern Comfort, and it's a focus on Southern folk tunes. What was the research process like for picking those works?
I've always been really curious about my family, and I knew more about my mother's side of my family than my father's. And so I was at a point where I wanted to know more. I knew that my father's father, my grandfather, was a coal miner. And so I joined Ancestry.com some years back, actually before I started Reverse Thread, which helped me with that project. But I was connecting with family members and finding out information about my father's side of the family and, you know, some relatives that would give me information. There's a family Bible, which someone has that has the information, but they won't they won't share that Bible or the information in it until they're gone. So I had to interview different family members and find information off of Ancestry.com. And so I knew he was a coal miner, born in the 1800s. And I was curious as to what the music would have been during his lifetime. So I started researching music going all the way back to his, you know, to his lifetime, and finding field recordings, some really amazing recordings, most of them just a single voice recording, no band backing it up, and from the Library of Congress and the John Works III Foundation, the Alabama Folklife Association, and Professor William Ferris sent me some books and put me in contact with several people to interview and get information for the record. So not only was I doing a lot of listening from that period, but also reading, you know, it had people sending me books or articles. And it was more like a history lesson for myself and really intriguing finding out information about my family. And unfortunately, I'm finding this with a lot of African-American families, especially of friends of mine. Sometimes they have information that they won't share. It's too painful for them to share, or they've burned information. They want to forget certain things. So understanding their pain, but for us that are trying to figure out our roots, it makes it a lot more difficult.
In doing the research on Ancestry.com and getting some personal information about him, finding that, and also finding the music, what kind of picture were you able to paint of what your grandfather's life was like? Because it couldn't have been easy.
No, definitely not an easy life. Not for him, nor for my grandmother, or anybody for that fact. But and just, you know, thinking about the rights that she didn't have even in her own house back at that during that time. But just very grueling work situation. Being an African American at that time, trying to find work, just being at a disadvantage, it was definitely not an easy life. And some of the recordings I came across, knowing they exist and then hearing them are two different things, but some of the very racist recordings that were made and to hear them just really took me aback. And At first, you know, you see things or read things like that, and at first I just didn't, you know, I wanted to put that aside. And I said, no, you know, that's part of our history, as ugly as it is. But it is, in fact, a part of our history. And with some of the ugliness that has been and the pain that has been a part of our history has come some really amazing art and music. So it's important not to bury that or to try and pretend it didn't exist. You know, I think the important thing is to acknowledge it and then move forward. So just finding some of those recordings and just seeing how difficult of a life it was for him. He and my grandmother had 14 children. So that was, you know, I can't even imagine trying to take care of that many children, and how much he had to work and be away from the home, and that my grandmother depended on some of, you know, the older siblings to help. And, you know, back in that time, in fact, even when I was a youngster, when I was 5, 6, 7, we'd go down to Alabama. My grandfather had already passed away before I was born, but we would go down and visit my grandmother. And, you know, it was still a very tiny house with just a couple of rooms, no bathroom in the house. You had to still go out to the outhouse, and we still had to get bathed in a big tin pail, get water from the well. So very different rural lifestyle. And of course, still nothing compared to what it was when he was alive, but it gave me respect for their way of living, you know, and what I know they had to go through from reading it. I can never put myself in their shoes, but I can definitely respect it.
Now, you write in your liner notes to Southern Comfort about your memories of going to visit your grandma when you were a young girl, and that was coming from your home in Detroit. I'm interested in the kind of cultural milieu that you experienced growing up in Detroit, and you went to Cass Technical High School, which is legendary in the jazz universe.
Right.
Is there something in the water, or was it just that there were so many folks that had come to Detroit looking for work that there couldn't not be a flashpoint there of jazz and blues and R&B that came out of that time?
Yeah, I think definitely, because so many people migrated from all over, not just the South, but, you know, Detroit has the largest Chaldean population. It was just all kinds of immigrants were coming there, especially for work in the car industry. And therefore Motown was started there. And all the jazz musicians during that time played those Motown sessions. And you had just a wealth of jazz clubs in the city, and great musicians always coming through and playing in Detroit as well. Then the symphony, of course. So there was just a wealth of music from every kind of culture there. And definitely the having the automotive industry there attracted all of these people, and you just it just made Detroit a very rich place to live and to come from.
I attend the Detroit Jazz Festival, not as a performer or an announcer, just as a fan. I've been up there 4 times now. My friend and I, who's from Detroit, we go up every other year. And Ron Carter was the artist in residence this year, and he attended also attended Cass Tech, and mm-hmm. I continue to be impressed at how much talent comes out of that place, that it feels sort of like it couldn't even exist within this universe, because it almost feels like the high school on fame, you know, that I imagine people just breaking into song and dance constantly, but I'm sure in reality it was just like any other high school. You just had an extra emphasis maybe on the performing arts.
Well, I mean, there wasn't even an extra emphasis on that. It was, you could go, you know, that was my major there. You had to pretty much know what you were going to major in college, and you would get your courses, your first year college courses, first or second year college courses at Cass. So whether it was performing arts, music, chem bio, there was for languages, just about any field that you wanted to go in college, Cass Tech offered those courses on top of your basic state requirements that you had to take. And there were, you know, with the music department and performing arts department, there would be times where just in the hallway or the lunchroom or the elevator, people would break into dance or song. It was a huge school there. When I went there, the population was already down. It was 4,000 students. So it was pretty, my graduation class was 700 something. And everybody you know, you had to maintain a certain grade level. If you had come, if you were coming from a private school, you had to test to get into Cass Tech. And they were very serious, you know, about your academics and whatever it was you were majoring in, whether it be, like I said, music, performing arts, or what have you. And you were very prepared when you went to college, and a lot of people could test out of certain required courses their first and second years because of the classes they took at Cass.
What is it about Ella Fitzgerald's repertoire that inspires you as a violinist to go on tour with an homage to the singer?
Not even the repertoire, because it didn't matter what Ella sang. She was going to make it hers. She just had an incredibly unique voice. And when I just remember whenever I'd hear her sing, it would grab me at my very core. Like, you just had to pay attention to whoever this was. She was just special. She was very, very special. And I think I wrote somewhere, I just, when I hear her sing, I melt inside. I feel like I know her, and I feel like she loves me. It's just this love that comes out of her voice when she sings. An incredible master of her instrument. And she did not box herself in. I think that's one of the many things that I love about her, is that she did not stick to any one genre of music. She sang whatever. She just loved music, and she would make it her own. And I love that. And I feel like whenever I have a tune that I need to learn, a standard or something, or a tune, I listen to several. I usually listen to vocalists if the tune has words, because then it helps me to understand the melody more, and understand what the tune is about. And so therefore, when I'm playing it and improvising over it, I have that message in my mind. But Ella was always one of the people that I listened to get her take on a tune. And she just, her attitude, when I read things that interviews done with her, watched the movie that was done on her, and just read about her life, she was just always seemed to be a very positive person. And one of my favorite quotes of hers is, just don't give up trying to do what you really want to do. Where there's love and inspiration, I don't think you can go wrong. And I have, someone gave that to me as a gift, and I have it in my practice room hung up. Because sometimes it's really difficult in this business of music, and it is a business, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, our own critics in our head, in my head, say, oh, you know, people aren't going to like this, or you shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't. And when I look at that, I remember, as long as I'm being honest and doing it out of love, then that's all I can ask of myself. I have to let the rest of it go. And so Ella, no matter what she sang, whether it was the pop music of the day, the American Songbook, she just daringly did it. And it was always amazing. It was always Ella. No matter what she did, it was Ella.
That's Regina Carter. The violinist will be here in Columbia Monday, January 23rd for a set with the We Always Swing Jazz Series at Stevens College's Lila Rainey Wood Hall. Thank you.